Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Governor Kathy Hochul says a budget deal is in place, but is it really a done deal? As lawmakers prepare to vote, several key issues remain unresolved. The New York Public News Network reporters unpack it and really tell us what's happening behind the scenes in Albany. How do we stay connected in a world that feels more divided than ever? Join us as we talk with Judy Balaban from the Committee for Equity and Justice about building stronger communities through honest conversations and collective action. What happens when a historic train depot becomes the heart of a small town's future? We're talking with the folks from the Calicoon Depot and the Calicoon Business Association about the transformative community project blending history, tourism, and local pride, plus local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump gave a startling reply to a question yesterday during an interview with NBC. Trump said he didn't know if he is required to uphold the U.S. Constitution. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
The context for this was a series of questions about whether non-citizens in the U.S. deserve due process. The president believes, frankly, he has a mandate, he thinks, on immigration, and said if you talk about due process for people who are not in the country legally, you'd have to deal with millions of trials. The backdrop to this is the high-profile case of a man who was sent from Maryland to El Salvador, despite a court order saying he should specifically not be deported there. The Supreme Court has called on the U.S. government to facilitate his return, but thus far he remains in El Salvador.
NPR's Asma Khalid reporting. An exhibit in a federal building in Washington that honored victims of gun violence no longer exists. The Trump administration has taken down the memorial created by the Department of Justice under President Biden. NPR's Kristen Wright reports some families are upset over the decision.
The Trump administration removed all 120 portraits from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Robert Godwin Sr.'s portrait and biography were part of the Faces of Gun Violence exhibit. His daughter, Brenda Joyner, is upset, especially because she wasn't notified beforehand.
Should there have been some bit of notification to us? Absolutely. But do I want my pictures, dad's picture sitting at the bottom of a dumpster? Hell no. No.
The Justice Department, in a statement to NPR, says, quote, the ATF will continue to honor the memory of all victims of violent crime, while at the same time preserving the rights of law-abiding Americans. A spokesman didn't answer a question asking where the portraits are now. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Stocks opened lower this morning as President Trump threatened a new 100% tax on imported movies. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 70 points in early trading.
President Trump said in a social media post he's directing the Commerce Department to begin the process of imposing a tax on foreign films. Trump complained about the incentives that other countries offer to attract filmmakers. The news is weighing on entertainment stocks, including Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery. OPEC and its allies plan to start pumping more oil next month. That's pushing crude oil prices down. The West Texas benchmark is now under $60 a barrel. That's below the price many U.S. oil producers say they need to justify drilling a new well. Retail gasoline prices held steady overnight at about $3.16 a gallon. AAA says that's 2 cents higher than a week ago, but 10 cents lower than this time last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks are still lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down more than 85 points at 41,232. The NASDAQ is down about 100 points. This is NPR. High-speed trains in Spain have been hit with delays today. Spanish officials say that some of the cabling used in the train's signaling system have been stolen from four different locations. Thousands of people have been traveling home after a holiday weekend in Spain. Some people were stuck overnight in their rail cars. Many airline passengers are complaining. That's after United Airlines announced it would eliminate about three dozen daily flights at one of the nation's busiest airports. NPR's Amy Held explains.
United announced the cancellation of 35 round-trip flights every day from Newark Airport because the technology air traffic controllers rely on has, quote, failed. In a statement, CEO Scott Kirby says it's clear the airport cannot handle the planes scheduled to operate there. This weekend at Newark.
It's really awful.
Odette Fortier planned to join her tour group, but got stuck on the tarmac.
We're going on a tour that we're meeting the group in Athens, so we can't go another day.
It's not just Newark. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says unless a whole new air traffic control system is built, people will lose lives. The current system relies in part on floppy disks and World War II-era radar. Upgrade funding is under consideration by Congress. Amy Held, NPR News.
Roman Catholic cardinals will convene their conclave Wednesday to select the next pope. After each vote, they burn their ballots. Black Smoke says they'll take another vote. White Smoke means the next pontiff has been chosen. The Vatican Fire Brigade has now installed the chimney on top of the Sistine Chapel. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for being with us. While Governor Kathy Hochul announced a general budget agreement last week between legislative leaders, the final budget is not quite done yet. State leaders acknowledge there are a number of outstanding issues, and members of the legislature need to vote on the actual budget bills in order for the final budget to be enacted. From the New York Public News Network, Chantel Destra spoke with Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC and the New York Public News Network, as well as Austin Jefferson of City and State New York, to discuss this year's budget cycle and the governor's announcement.
Thank you both so much for joining me here today.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having us.
Now, naturally, I wanted to start with the governor's announcement of a general budget deal between leaders. We know that this does not necessarily mean a final state budget. Lawmakers still need to vote on the actual budget bills before the budget can be enacted. But I wanted to just get your general reaction to that announcement by the governor and the timing of it. What did you make of it?
Well, governors have the prerogative of announcing the budget kind of on their own terms, and that's certainly what we saw Governor Hochul do this week. She wanted to emphasize that the main policy priorities that she saw in this spending plan, in her estimation, she has achieved. That includes some kind of an affordability agenda, which will include rebate checks for middle-class New York families. It includes a bell-to-bell ban on students' cell phone use. It includes changes to the discovery process. That's the way that evidence is shared before a criminal trial. And it also includes changes to the standard by which a person can be involuntarily committed for mental health treatment. And I guess the fifth one is restrictions on the wearing of masks in public. So yeah. Hochul achieved general agreement with legislative leaders on those things. She declared victory. She started touring the state to gain political points.
She did.
And she's left it to lawmakers to work out the rest. Now, that is a break from other years of covering the budget in which you have a gubernatorial announcement generally about 36 hours before bills start getting printed and all the finer points get worked out. So Hochul may have taken that victory lap a little earlier than previous governors. And as we record this, we still have not seen finalized budget legislation. And you're starting to hear some more grumbling by rank and file lawmakers who are wondering when there actually will be a full budget deal.
Yeah, and I wanted to get into some of the policy that have been driving negotiations. We saw a big focus this year around discovery reform. The governor wanted to change how and when prosecutors must turn over evidence in court cases. Meanwhile, members of the legislature felt that there were other ways to address court dismissals without necessarily tinkering with the entire system. So why was this such a contentious issue throughout budget negotiations that ultimately stalled negotiations for some time?
I think for criminal justice reformers, it really felt like going back on that promise to make a more equitable criminal justice system. Because the idea behind, I think, discovery initially was just that, you know, we want to give people who are involved in the justice system a chance at a faster trial, a better chance at, you know, getting their side heard within a trial. And to go back on that by saying, well, only certain kinds of information need to be shared and right. Only on a certain timeline, and now the judge has far more leeway of deciding what is or isn't a sort of, you know, malpractice on the side of a prosecutor. I think to a lot of people, it felt like we're kind of giving up on the idea of giving New Yorkers a chance at getting their side heard in court. I understand why this was important to the governor, but I think if you are someone who hangs their hat on, you know, making a better justice system for New Yorkers, it definitely feels like we're going in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
I was surprised that this debate occupied so much oxygen in budget talks, because it is very, very, very much in the weeds. It's very difficult to understand. I've struggled as a broadcaster to quickly convey to people what we're even talking about. And Austin, you're absolutely right. This is something that was critical and a red alert for people who have advocated for a fairer criminal justice system that gives more rights to criminal defendants. I think from Governor Hochul's perspective, she wanted to be seen as taking a stance that would improve public safety. And so by standing with prosecutors, by standing with New York City district attorneys specifically, who have said that this law resulted in an increase in case dismissals, Hochul is able to say that she took an action that will help increase public safety. Whether it's actually going to work, whether it's actually going to drive things down, that remains to be seen. But going into a 2026 expected reelection campaign for Governor Hochul, she wanted to use this budget to gain achievements upon which she could build a reelection message. And I think, again, having that ability to say, I stood with prosecutors, is something that I expect we're going to be hearing a lot more of from the governor, particularly in the context of a campaign next year.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think this year more than ever, we saw the governor apply more force than usual, right? Like, she brought in district attorneys from across the state to drive home that messaging that there needed to be reforms to discovery law. And she sort of doubled down on her take that a good budget is better than an on-time one. So that was super interesting to me, and we'll see whether or not that was an effective strategy. But I wanted to turn to mask bans across the state. Jimmy, I know you've done some really awesome and thorough reporting on this issue. So can you tell us about the impetus of the proposal by the governor?
Well, this actually started last year. There were some videos that circulated on social media showing pro-Palestinian protesters on New York City subway cars. I think the best way to describe it is harassing riders. And these people were wearing masks. And so that led to concern and outcry, particularly from Jewish groups who said that they're concerned that people are wearing masks under the cloak of anonymity and harassing people who are Jewish, who appear to be Jewish by wearing a skull cap or other religious garb. And Hochul at the time denounced that. And then over the course of budget negotiations, this was sort of a late add for her. There had been a piece of legislation percolating in the state Senate and the Assembly, which would have done two things. It would have created a new crime of quote-unquote masked harassment, and it also would have increased the penalties for people who are wearing a mask to conceal their identity while they are perhaps committing harassment or assault or some other underlying crime. Hochul kind of went all over the place in the course of budget negotiations on this issue. First, she said she backed that piece of legislation. Then we heard that she was softening to say, we just want to have some kind of a penalty enhancer. And that softening happened because it was really difficult for her to explain and for law enforcement to explain, well, your intent is that you're wearing a mask for medical reasons. Yeah. Your intent is that you're wearing a mask for medical, for religious purposes.
Right.
But Jimmy, you're wearing a mask, you're clearly going to harass somebody. You're under arrest, you're not under arrest, you're not under arrest. Mm-hmm. And the potential for disparate enforcement, and particularly how we've seen over time, laws where there's discretion for enforcement have impacted black and brown people and low-income people, that led state lawmakers to really push back. So where lawmakers have apparently finally landed, and I have to say we have not actually seen the language on this deal, was to create an additional charge against a person who commits an underlying serious offense, something like petty larceny, something like harassment, and that if they are wearing a mask to conceal their identity while they are committing said underlying offense, there can be an additional charge against them. So the governor can say, as she did this week, that she is getting tough and putting penalties on people who are using masks to conceal their identity, but hopefully and perhaps avoiding some of those concerns about discretion and disparate impact in the enforcement.
And another big issue was cell phones in schools. The governor wanted to implement what was called a bell-to-bell ban on cell phones for students. And parents argued, you know, they wanted to be able to communicate with their children in the event of an emergency. Ultimately, the governor did get that in the final budget deal from what she's, you know, announcing. But I wanted to discuss with you all, how did that issue take shape throughout the budget process this year?
So I think it helped her a lot that state lawmakers and the teachers unions were pretty much on board from the beginning. It was more getting districts and parents to right. understand, I guess, how this would play out. I mean, her strategy of having law enforcement go to schools and sort of explain, like, we're not going to put your kids in a situation where there's no one there to help them. It's just that teachers and the police, we are the resources, not the phones. Mm-hmm. I think that message took a while to communicate, but I think they got there over time where lawmakers felt very comfortable saying, we're going to do this.
Right. And another big issue, of course, was involuntary commitment being used as a means to help or address people battling mental illness. So how did that issue ultimately take shape?
Really, and again, this is really difficult to describe having not seen the exact budget language, but what I understand from my reporting is that Hochul's push to broaden the standard from someone who is demonstrating that they will be a risk of imminent harm to themselves or others, that's either someone talking about self-harm or suicide or someone threatening violence against another person, to someone who essentially, as we understand it, is evincing that they cannot care for their basic needs, not feeding, not clothing, not seeking medical care for themselves. What lawmakers seem to have done is put more service requirements on the front and the back end of that. They have pushed to have more non-police responders be involved in cases where emergency calls come in for a person in seeming distress, and also to make sure that once that person is taken to a hospital, there's much more planning on the back end before they are released to make sure that they are connected with services over the long term and not involved in some sort of a revolving door.
In the last, you know, 30 seconds that we have left, I wanted to hear from each of you if there was anything that surprised you this year in the budget process.
I mean, I think twofold just how long this is taking, only because I think the start of the year, a lot of us were under the impression that this was a no-frills budget, just some pretty straightforward public safety reforms, maybe the self-help plan as we talked about. In theory, should not have taken that much longer than the April 1st deadline, but here we are in May. And beyond that, I mean, I think the housing voucher program that she's been against for years, to bring that back at the last second, seemingly, even if the funding level is much lower than what lawmakers had, you know, initially had in mind, it's a very surprising about face for her, especially since the point being made that affordability could be addressed through this, it didn't really seem to faze her.
Right. Jimmy?
I agree exactly with what you said, Austin. The Housing Access Voucher Program was a surprise, and the tardiness of this budget was striking to me. That also happened at a time where we're seeing major fiscal risks to New York unfold. The federal government is talking about reducing funding for states through budgetary programs. That's what the rhetoric is from the Trump administration. New York receives more than $90 billion in federal funds in a $250-plus billion spending plan. And also, we're seeing the economic condition become much more uncertain as the impact of President Trump's tariffs roll through the economy and cause gyrations in the stock market. So I was surprised that that was really not part of the conversation as lawmakers were crafting this budget.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this morning. But thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks, Chantel.
And we were speaking with Jimmy Vielkind of WNYC and the New York Public News Network, as well as Austin Jefferson of City and State New York.
Thanks to the New York Public News Network for that update. We'll take a break. And when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected. May 5th is the last day to register to vote in Pennsylvania. The last day to apply for a civilian absentee or mail-in ballot is May 13th. The last day for Pennsylvania County Boards of Elections to receive mail-in and civilian absentee ballots is May 20th at 8 p.m. Primary Election Day is May 20th. Pennsylvania polls are open on primary election day from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. More information at pa.gov. This is Radio Catskill.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Dow's dropped more than 100 points. The S&P 500 set to end a 9-day winning streak. And what did Friday's jobs report have to say? Here to tell us all about it is our own local economist and author, James B. Huntington. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, James B., what did that Friday's jobs report have to say? It looks like it was encouraging in some ways.
Yes, it certainly was. We had 177,000 net new non-farm payroll positions, which is higher than the estimates of 125 and 135 I saw published. We had seasonally adjusted unemployment holding at 4.2%. The two measures of how common it is for people to be working or close to it, the employment population ratio and the labor force participation rate, each gained 0.1% to 60.0 and 62.6%. Unadjusted joblessness, seasonally mainly but not completely, fell 0.3% to 3.9%. The number of people working part-time for economic reasons or keeping that sort of work while thus far unsuccessfully seeking full-time opportunities lost 100,000 to 4.7 million. Unadjusted unemployment rose an excellent 631,000 to reach just over 164 million, which is possibly an all-time high, one of the highest in many months or even years, if not quite that. Numbers that got worse were a 200,000 increase in those who say they are out of work for 27 weeks or longer. That's now 1.7 million. And average hourly non-farm payroll earnings edged out by inflation, a little bit lower than inflation at 36.06. For 6 cents more. The American job shortage number, or AJSN, which shows how many positions have latent demand enough for them to be quickly filled, new positions, that had a fine month. It lost almost 700,000, and it's now at 16.0 million. Otherwise, this was certainly a thumbs-up month. We had more people leaving the labor force as compared with the previous month, but it seemed like, judging by the number of jobs and the unemployment numbers and such, that the people who left were those who were not getting positions. So that's relatively harmless. So when we, and it's important to notice, we cannot take 177,000 net new jobs for granted. There's no reason. Population increase is lower than that. Considering some of the other things that are going on with the economy, it's a little bit surprising. So we'll all be spectators, essentially, and watch Washington and see what goes into next month's jobs report.
Right. We have to keep an eye on all of it because we were looking at economic growth in the first quarter. What did that show?
Well, the U.S. economy shrank. It was down 0.3%. Credited for that are not only the tariffs we've had, but a lot of uncertainty and jitteriness and businesses not knowing what to do. So that was bad news. It's not a recession all by itself, but it's something that points in that direction. So That's a real change from a few months ago when growth was very strong. So we'll see. We'll see how this continues. But since this is a quarterly report, it's going to be 3 months until we see another one of these.
And what happened with the Fed's favorite inflation measure?
Yes, that favorite inflation measure is the Personal Consumption Expenditures, or PCE, index. It stayed much the same as it did previously, but price growth overall, including inflation, was down a little bit. So it's a 2.3% on an annual basis. That's getting awfully close to that magic 2% we've been hearing about. So the core number also stayed the same, but a little bit higher, 2.6% up on an annual basis. Prices for goods, costs for goods, actually dropped 0.3%. So mostly that came from durable goods, because non-durable goods such as food actually increased a bit. Services were 3.5% higher in March than a year before, which is well over that 2%, but it's lower than 3.8%, which we saw there.
So what does this do to consumer confidence with these all these different measures coming in to view?
Well, whatever it's supposed to do, it's not working very well, as consumer confidence fell to its lowest level in nearly 5 years. Concerns about tariffs and trade uncertainty, mainly. People are not happy about these things. One thing that's part of this is the expectations index, based on consumers' short-term outlook for business and labor market conditions. That's down 12.5 points to 54.4, the lowest level since October 2011, which is surprising because the labor market is doing perfectly well. It shows how bad the views of consumers are right now. The present situation index, another thing, based on consumers' assessments of current business and labor market conditions, that went down just a little bit, 0.9 points to 133.5. So we have some real weakness as far as what people are think is going to happen, and it doesn't seem like stopping these tariffs is doing much good. It's more a matter of you've got to stop threatening them, and I don't know if that is going to happen.
And let's talk a little bit about this loophole that allowed some low-cost Chinese-made items to enter the U.S. without import fees. That's being closed. What will the end of that mean?
Well, it's something I bet most people listening to this program have got goods from China that have had no tariffs. And with this loophole staying around, they still wouldn't. It used to be a $5 limit for packages sent directly from China to consumers without anyone else. They call it de minimis, which is a Latin for very small. It's the same term they use when figuring out what you need to do if you made $20 and selling things at a profit over the past year. That's de minimis, and the IRS doesn't even care about it. But the same expression here, it allowed products, actually, it went up from $5 in 1978, the maximum amount, to $200 in 1993, which is where it has been, or where it was for 23 years, and then it's been $800 ever since 2016. So if you order something from a website that's made in China and they send it directly to you instead of selling it to a retailer who resells it, then you are not going to see it. You were not going to see any tariffs, but they have got rid of that exemption now. So that may end up being quite expensive. It is a serious possibility that if you buy what was a $10 T-shirt and Chinese vendors are willing to sell them to you for that, it's going to be $24.50 by the time it arrives. it's the way the mechanics of this work are. The carriers will most likely collect the tariff charges for things before they can even send something in China. It will be picked up at the source there. When it gets to the U.S., the U.S. Customs will process your package and collect the tariff from the carrier. So a lot of them will need to be processed every day, even if that's already been done. They need to check it out and make sure what's happened. I mean, it's literally millions of packages every day will have to be checked out and seen if the tariffs are actually on there. And if your carrier did not pay the full amount, then customs will hold it for a length of time, and eventually they will sell it or dispose of it. So it's disappointing, but if we don't have a resolution real soon to these Chinese tariffs, we may get stuck with much higher prices on things we buy even online without even thinking about it.
It's already had an impact on Chinese bargain retailer Temu. They have stopped shipping products from China directly to the U.S. as the end of this de minimis provision takes effect. Items shipped directly from China, which previously were all over their site, are now labeled as out of stock. So already having some impact as that loophole is cut off. What's the impact on the numbers? Let's look at the markets this morning and see how prices changed as well in the last week.
Okay, well, gold, $32.87, up $9. It's up $30 from that this morning somehow. So it went up three times as much this morning so far as it went up all week. It was taking pause, really. It was staying there. It's reached 3,500, so it's down some from that. Not doing as much, but traders liked it this morning. Silver is 32.29. That's down a dime. That's been dropping in relation to silver. The ratio now is almost 103-1, which is awfully high historically. Silver lost 47 cents in the week-to-week comparison ending early this morning. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 41.317 for a 1,200 point gain for that week interval, and now it's down about 60 points from this morning. It's gone up from the low it was at. And NASDAQ, 17.978 for a 600 point, a similar, actually higher percentage gain over the past week, but this morning it's down to 17.859. That's about 119. So NASDAQ is doing much poorer than the Dow now. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $57.02, over $6. We're ready for cheaper gas. I want to see it soon.
Still not seeing it.
It keeps getting lower and lower. Bitcoin, $94,600, a $72 loss, which is about as close to breaking even over a week for that volatile thing can ever do. British pound, 1.3299, down a quarter of a cent. So the dollar has a little more credibility and stability. It's been a quiet week for the volatile large announcements. Euro, 1.1340, down a tenth of a cent. Japanese 100 yen coin, 69 cents, down a penny. That's been drifting down. So it seemed like a good stable week, but really it's because I think that it's our commander-in-chief who has switched over to saying nutty things about wanting to reinstate moldering 60-year-old prisons, and he's not threatening new tariffs that do real damage and significant damage.
Well, thanks for keeping an eye on all of the...
It's been a good week. We'll see.
Thanks for keeping an eye on all of the whiplash nutty news that's going on in the economy. It's James P. Huntington, our local economist and author, who joins us every Monday. Thanks. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Liz.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, the Committee for Equity and Justice talking about building stronger communities through honest conversations and collective action. That's next. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. In a time with so many entertainment options, how is it that live theater is still alive?
We're not a real business. We have hits, but in between those hits, we have four flops in a row.
We'll go behind the scenes and chart the creation of a new musical, and we'll ask the tough questions.
Are you trying to get me killed?
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFRadio.org.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. With social change happening at lightning speed, many folks wonder, how do we stay connected, informed, and united? Joining us today is Judy Balaban and Kathy Aberman of the Committee for Equity and Justice, a local group committed to creating space for honest conversation, shared understanding, and collective action. They have their monthly meetup coming up at the E.B. Crawford Library in Monticello, and they're here to tell us more. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
What inspired these monthly meetups, Judy? What do you hope participants walk away with?
Well, I think it's really a desire to help bring the community together, to help us understand where our perspective on topics comes from, and then to hopefully have an open mind to understand where other people get their ideas and perspectives from. I think that will give us an opportunity to find our commonalities more. And it's an interesting process because, I mean, I've been going through it myself. We've been doing these conversations since September of 23. And I find myself sometimes having a response to something I hear on the news and or something I hear somebody say. And I'm aware enough to be able to pause and step back and say, where the heck did that come from? You know, instead of just accepting it with, you know, without giving it any thought. So that's kind of really what the idea of the conversations is.
We're living in a time of great change, some progress, many setbacks. In your view, what do you guys think are the most urgent equity and justice issues facing our community today? Kathy? Judy, either of you?
Yeah. I think Sullivan County issues, drug abuse, homelessness, poverty, I think those are big issues. I think how our immigrant neighbors are being treated, that's a big issue for us. Food insecurity is a big issue. And press freedom, the, you know, concern about NPR and PBS losing funding, that's a big issue. Our democracy, you know, there are so many. Yeah.
You mentioned that you've been having these monthly meetups. I think we had you here last time you had one before. What's something that stuck with you or shifted your perspective from one of these monthly meetups?
I think for me, a while ago, we talked about immigration, and the way we discussed it was we initially talked about, okay, so what is your personal connection to immigration, you know, and pretty much everybody there. And we had a nice crowd, I'd say between 15 and 20 people. Everybody was either immigrants or children of immigrants. And then we asked people to, we broke up into small groups and people talked about, well, you know, what are the good things that immigrants bring to our country and what are the difficulties that immigrants cause in our country? And we made a list. And then we asked people to come back the second month and talk about what research they might have done on, okay, well, is that really something that's good that immigrants bring? Or is that really something that's a hardship that immigrants bring to the country and the rest of the people? And just doing that research and seeing that if you went to, you know, a conservative think tank, you might get different data, or the data was used differently than if you went to a more progressive think tank or a libertarian think tank like the Cato Institute. So just to see that the information we get can be used in different ways. And the idea is, let's think. You know, that's, you know, that's one of the things that the conversations is here to stimulate, our ability to think, because we really, really need to do that.
And your next community conversation is Thursday at 6 at the E.B. Crawford Library in Monticello. The topic, how do you feel about the first 100 days of the new Trump administration? What do you hope folks take away from this, or what kind of conversation do you hope to action out of this?
I wanted to say something before answering that question.
Sure.
One of the, for me, one of the prime reasons I wanted to be involved in this was that I think we have a tendency not to listen. We have a tendency when somebody else is speaking, we're already forming our reply or our argument. And to me, it was really important to focus on just listening, having people really just listen to what other people think. And as Judy said, you know, it's we try to understand where our own positions and feelings come from, but to also try to understand where other people's positions and feelings come from, so that it's not all just contentious.
Yeah.
It's really an attempt to understand more.
And then how do you take those insights and that listening and then turn that into action after these meetings? What helps you? What can you do or to take an action with that?
I don't see myself taking actions on what other people think or feel. If they present a position that advocates doing something and I'll think about that, yes, and maybe I'll go there or maybe not, you know, it depends on what my position is on it. But, for example, I went to a conference last week on garbage, and Sullivan County is facing a huge problem with garbage right now. So there's the opportunity to act on a state level or a local level. So that's my choice. You know, where am I going to put my energy? I'm going to put it on a local level. Other people wanted to work on state things. So
but this is an opportunity for folks to just to get together, listen, and yeah, share those insights from each other, have that space to be able to just hear what those perspectives are, and then hopefully individually maybe take it into action in other places.
Right. And I mean, there are many, you know, rallies happening frequently in the community, and maybe people will recognize, okay, we do think the same way about this particular issue, and maybe I will go and be supportive at this particular rally, while maybe they wouldn't have thought about it before. I mean, my goal from the first from day one about bringing people together with different political viewpoints is to try to get money out of our politics. When I grew up, money was very limited, and not that everything was perfect, but I think that no matter where you are politically, you see that this is an issue. So we haven't gotten around to having that conversation yet, but that's, you know, that's kind of my hope. Oh, yeah, we can all agree on this. Let's contact our representative. Let's get out in the street. Let's get on, you know, public media and talk about it. And just so the idea is to have this conversation and then to be motivated enough by what we're talking about to go take it outside, right. You know. And it's like what Kathy was talking about with, you know, with the garbage. You know, go to the schools and, you know, have teachers come or whoever's coming to our conversation. Go home and talk about it with your kids. That's when I started recycling, was when my kids came home from school and said, Ma, you know, that plastic is no good.
A lot of smoking stopped when kids came home from school and said, Mom, Dad, stop smoking. Right. It's bad.
Yeah.
Well, we're running out of time here, so I want to remind folks of where they can join the monthly meetup and get the details for it.
Okay. So this Thursday, it's always the second Thursday of the month. So it's May 8th from 6 to 7:30 at the Ethel B. Crawford Public Library in Monticello. So hope to see you there.
All right. Judy Balaban and Kathy Aberman of the Committee for Equity and Justice, providing folks a space to talk and listen and maybe not feel so discouraged. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the latest developments at the Calicoon Depot in Calicoon, New York. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, the fight to defend the legal status of Venezuelans in the United States.
I felt that all these years of advocacy were just prep time for this.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Jason Dole. The White House, you may have heard, has proposed eliminating federal funding for public media in its budget, issued an executive order to block support for PBS and NPR, and wants to claw back funding that Congress already approved. The threat to public media is real, it's here, and it is growing. The stakes have never been higher. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org. That's protectmypublicmedia.org. And tell Congress to protect Radio Catskill while there's still time.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Right now, let's go to the heart of the hamlet of Calicoon, where this unique collaboration of the Calicoon Depot and the Calicoon Business Association are bringing to life one of the area's most historic landmarks. Joining us are Darko Hrjanović and Tong Kaokam of the Calicoon Business Association. Darko is with the Calicoon Depot. They are working on the Calicoon Train Depot Project, an initiative to restore and repurpose the town's historic train station as a vibrant hub for visitors, events, education, and cultural programming. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Thanks for having us.
Let's give listeners a little bit of a background here. Darko, we've had you on before to talk about the depot. Let's talk about the intersection between the depot and the business association. How does that work?
Well, the business association is holds the lease to the depot, and the Calicoon Depot Inc. was formulated to specifically manage, oversee, and promote the depot grounds. So the CBA is a wider reach. They really address many issues around the hamlet, whereas we specifically look for opportunities to celebrate and use the depot as a resource for the community.
And Tom, can you talk a little bit more about your involvement as president of the Business Association here?
Sure. The Calicoon Business Association, you know, we're responsible for obtaining funding to, like, such as grants and stuff like this to get a lot of these projects running and a beautification of the town. And getting a lot of these projects off the ground and work with the CDI to get a lot of these events in town happening.
Now, this is a major undertaking. It doesn't happen overnight. Why do you guys think this is important for Calicoon and the Upper Delaware region, this project?
We want to make it a visitor center to bring people in the community to get together and create a centralized area for where the community and the arts and everything can come and help make the town more beautiful and get everybody involved. So we're really excited about this project to get it off the ground. And as you know, it's been a long time since anything's been happening there. So and we've already got funding for the first phase, and we've got all the architectures and everybody in place already. So it's really exciting to get this moving and going.
So there was some activity last summer when we talked. Obviously, winter, you stop a little bit here, as everybody does in the region. What's coming up now in this next phase of the Calicoon Depot?
Okay, so where we are presently is that over the stretch of time from last year to this year, we began the process of actually getting the depot renovated. We solicited, we put an RFP out for architectural services. We had 11 responses. We interviewed.
That's a nice number.
Yeah, no, it was a lot of interest. I mean, I think people realize and recognize the importance that the depot has, both as a historic structure. As you said, there's a lot of quality space and presence that a lot of other hamlets really don't have, a town square like this. So the effort was to bring on a professional services. We hired an architectural firm, and they began developing the architectural drawings. We had a 50% submission recently that we reviewed. And their 100% drawings will be delivered at the end of June, which means that shortly thereafter, around the end of July, we'll be soliciting contractors and we'll be releasing a contract to actually build the visitor center into the phase one work.
So a little bit more activity folks will see around the hamlet this summer or this year.
Right. Hopefully they're going to start seeing some construction. And then part and parcel to that is we also host a lot of events. So while the interior is being developed, renovated, and being prepared for the visitor center for the Upper Delaware Scenic Byway, we want to celebrate the richness of the community. So we create events in a forum where we showcase the talents, the culture, the ecology that's in the area. Is one of the reasons why people come to Calicoon. They recognize the richness, they recognize the historic nature of the town, and they want to celebrate and be part of that. And we offer a means for them to see what is around and what is available in the hamlet.
And Tung, the Calicoon hamlet of Calicoon has been known for some of these great events like Art Walk or Dickens on the Delaware. How do you see the depot working into an anchor for events like these and other events?
Absolutely. We do a lot of these annual events such as the Country Fair, which is coming up soon. We have a lot of townspeople involved, such as the Job Corps. They volunteer to help and get some of these things going, the inside, the outside. It's going to bring the community together to showcase a lot of events that we have in town outside of the annual events that we have going on. We're really excited to include and have more projects going on, such as the garden that we're doing there too.
And why do you – well, can you talk a little bit about some of the community members and local volunteers who've supported this project so far in Calicoon? You mentioned Job Corps folks.
A lot of the Job Corps students, they come and we volunteer to do a lot of stuff on the outside, the inside, our facility maintenance, carpentry, trade. Students, they come over there. They help do a lot of stuff to help to get the project going because, you know, some of the fundings are important and – it helps with the funding part of it, so we don't have to pay volunteers to do stuff. And a lot of folks in town, too. So with that being said, you know, the more volunteers we have, the better. So it takes a hamlet. It takes a town. So and if people would like to volunteer, please contact us and come help out.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting also is that we both support each other. Like we're reliant on a lot of the students coming, and it's an opportunity for them to apply their skills. What's interesting also is that when the students do come to town, they are surprised by what the hamlet has to offer. They didn't know there was a library. They didn't know about some of the commercial businesses. Some of them never even saw, you know, had access to the river. So the interaction, I think, has been very helpful on both ends. It allows the students to come to town and to help in the development of the depot. while at the same time gives them a little sense of what this community is about, who is the community, and where the community actually resides in terms of the surroundings.
We talked about the timeline for this next phase. Is there an overall timeline for completion? What does that look like?
Well, it's very reliant on funding. So right now the funding is in place, so the schedule is reflective of that. So we're on schedule to complete this first phase of the project, which is the visitor center. We do have grants in place that we're waiting for feedback on in terms of fixing the exterior of the building. There's a need for additional funds to replace the roof. There's a need to deal with the infiltration of the water in the basement of the building. But going forward, the phasing of the development of the town square, some of the event space, the landscaping that DK mentioned, becomes reliant on additional funding donations. You know, we look to communities, we look to the residents to help, and we have grant writers who are pursuing, you know, additional funding.
A town hall meeting tomorrow night?
That's right.
The Delaware Youth Center. Tell us more about that.
It's going to be at the Delaware Youth Center over there in Calicoon at 6 p.m. So we invite anybody that's interested to finding more about the project and where we are to please come by. It starts at 6 p.m. and we will provide all the information that you need there and answer all your questions that you have.
And where can folks get more information about both projects? Where the website, social media?
Yeah, so our web is on www.thecalicoondepot.org. If you have an email, you want to drop it off, it's allaboard@thecalicoondepot.org.
Tom.
And for the CBA, Calicoon Business Association, so just visit calicoon.com. Our website provides all the information you need about what's going on in the hamlet and volunteer opportunities and how you can get involved and see what's going on.
There's another project going on in town separate from this, the silos restoration there, another historic landmark. A lot of historic preservation going on in the hamlet. What is it you guys both want folks to think of the hamlet, the depot, say 5 years from now? What is it you hope that people are attracted to there?
Well, I think what we're all striving to do is twofold. One is the preservation of the quality that gives definition to the hamlet, so that people have moved to the area, people have assimilated to the hamlet, and the quality of life is something that they want preserved. And so building on that, we want to develop things that will attract more people to come and experience the richness of the area. And just to mention, on May 17th, I believe the library, this is History Month, the library will be hosting a presentation that will speak to the history of the depot, the library, and the silos that you just mentioned. And there'll be some updates of where they were, where they are, and where they're going to be.
And to add to that, I agree with that. It's about preservation, conservation, and expanding the hamlet to incorporate more people of their surrounding neighborhoods and counties and hamlets to come and visit Calicoon and find out what we're all about and help us make it more beautiful for everybody else involved.
Darko Hrljanović, president of the Calicoon Depot Incorporated, and Tong Keokam of the Calicoon Business Association, also the president of the CBA, right?
Correct.
I got two presidents here. Thank you guys both so much for being here. We appreciate
it. Thank you much.
Thank you, Tim, for having
hopefully
us.
Hopefully we'll see you all tomorrow.
Tomorrow. All right, that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that you can learn more about the threat to public media on our website, and you can also learn how you can contact your Congress folks and help support us, too. WJFFradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Sullivan 180, building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Alliances have shifted.
I'm aligned with the United States of America and for the good of the world.
Markets have been sent reeling.
At the moment, we're living through extreme uncertainty.
President Trump has remade relationships with allies and adversaries alike and shaken the global economy. I'm Michelle Martin. Join me for a live special report from NPR News as we look at the first 100 days of the Trump administration and consider what's next.
Tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. a period of wet weather for the next few days, breezy with periods of rain today and tonight. Tonight's high 50, today's high 58, tonight's low 53. Cloudy and a shower or thunderstorm possible tomorrow, high 61. Showers around tomorrow night and Wednesday. Wednesday's high 62. Might see a little break on Thursday, but then periods of rain again Friday. Happy spring. On Point is next.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.